from TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Patrick Michaels, stepping in this week for Jonathan McNamara, who's so steadfastly led this show for the last 2 years and made it what it is today, a half-hour discussion of Texas politics and culture with the staff of the Texas Observer magazine. This week, we've got a look at the results of this year's elections, what the big Republican wins mean for the GOP and Democrats in Texas, and how they'll affect the policy decisions in the Capitol next year. The Observer convened a panel of expert reporters and lawmakers to help answer those questions at a live event at the North Door here in Austin on November 11th. What follows is an edited version of the conversation, cut to fit our show. You can hear the whole thing at texasobserver.org. And to introduce our guests, let's join Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder on stage at the North Door.
Thank you all for coming tonight. We have a very esteemed panel here with us. So I'll start right here with Representative Donna Howard, a Democrat from Austin. Well, one interesting thing to note is that when Representative Howard came into office in 2006, she was the only white Democratic woman in the Texas legislature. As time went on, she got a few colleagues to join her, but after last week's election, she's back to being the only white Democratic female in the Texas legislature. She is, what's it, WD-40 woman? We need a new...
WD-1.
Yeah, there we go. And this is Harvey Kronberg, the editor, publisher, owner, and impresario of the Quorum Report. There you go. We have Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly. She has a cover story... Right? She has a story, a big feature. See, I only read the web version, so sorry about that. About Dan Patrick, which you all should really check out. It is she has a debate with Lieutenant Governor-elect Dan Patrick about ISIS and the border, and it's really worth reading. We have Chris Hooks. He is a political writer for the Texas Observer. I don't know any other parts of your resume, so. And on our far left, although on the right, from the audience perspective, we have Representative Jason Villalba. He's a Republican from Dallas. I want to turn to the voter ID law. It was in effect for this election. I think there were something fewer than 400 election identification certificates, the form of photo ID issued by the state, specifically for voting if people didn't have the other six approved forms. But it's also kind of hard to get a handle on what impact the law had on voters, in particular the 500,000-plus voters who were registered but don't have one of the forms of ID. Does somebody want to address like what impact that may or may not have had?
Well, I was trying to find some data on this question. I think voter ID is unconstitutional. I don't think you need an ID to vote. That's not where the right to vote comes from. But that's my only Democratic moment of the night, I think. But with that said, I think the data on it is, of course, somewhat inconclusive. 538, Nate Silver did a review of studies about voter ID laws in other states in 2012 and found that on average, there was maybe about 2% decrease in turnout after states passed voter ID laws, but that it varied a lot by state. GAO, the Government Accountability Office, that's right, did a sort of study of studies and found that in 10 studies with voter ID laws, 5 had no measurable effect, 4 decreased turnout marginally, 1 increased turnout marginally. So in a context like this, where statewide elections are being won by 20-point margins, I mean, it didn't sway the outcome of anything, I think. But with that said, I mean, I think that we don't need it. It's not stopping any election fraud. The idea of it stopping election fraud, I've always thought, is really silly. And we've seen kind of these scattered reports about individual voters who are thwarted by it and how the kind of nominal cost and money and time of getting an ID sounds pretty minimal to maybe most of us here, but it's actually pretty serious if you have to get, you know, a bus to the DPS to get an ID. So I don't think it was a major factor in the elections in the end, but I think it's an issue that is rightly controversial.
Well, let me disagree with Ms. Greeter on whether or not this is constitutional. I think it is constitutional. I think we're seeing that in the courts play out. I think the good news for us in this room is that we're going to have the courts make this determination for us. I mean, the legislature has acted. It has gone through the district court, now the appellate court, and ultimately will be at the Supreme Court. So this decision will be made and determined very shortly. I think we're going to see some answers from the Supremes. Now, I will say this. The people are behind this measure overwhelmingly. If you look at the statistics, most people are in favor of this. Now, in this room, perhaps not, but if you look at the overall statistics, you will find that most people do not find it an unreasonable measure to ask someone to present a photograph ID when they're going to cast the ballot. I mean, the franchise is one of our sacred rights as citizens. To ask someone to present identification to show that who you are does not seem unreasonable to the average nonpartisan person. So I'm not talking about Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking about going out to a group of 10 people in at a UT football game and asking them, is it unfair to ask someone to do this? And I think 9 or 8 out of 10 of them, the statistic will show you, I think it's eminently reasonable. And
that's
so,
why the federal court said that Texas intentionally discriminated in this specific.
An appellate court said that,
yes.
Right? A district court did not. And I think we're going to see it at the Supreme Court level. They'll rule on this. Now, you and I can disagree all day long, but and the Supremes. But
my problem, Jason, is you're conflating voter ID with Texas voter ID. This is the most restrictive voter ID bill in the country. If my driver's license says Harvey Initial J. Kronberg and my voter registration says Harvey J. J. A. Y. Kronberg, I can only cast a provisional vote and then come back within five days to get my vote validated. Now, that is absolutely
it's
Supreme Court has surprised me in numerous fashions in what their interpretation of the Constitution is. So maybe it is constitutional. Judge Posner up in Indiana said it was the worst decision he ever made, but he also wrote that no harm had yet been demonstrated. Well, if you lose 2% of your voters, that's a harm that's been demonstrated.
But we don't know if we have lost 2% of our voters. So look, every reasonable Republican, I should say, including this one, would make the necessary changes to ameliorate the concerns that you have.
Yeah.
So if we have 4 identification badges that work, a driver's license, a passport, a military ID, or whatever, and that's insufficient for the purposes that you and I might discuss, you know, let's talk about how we expand that to make it more reasonable and ameliorate those concerns that we have in the rural areas, right? But fundamentally, asking someone to present proof that they are who they are is not unreasonable.
To me, this is talking about it from the wrong, totally wrong perspective in the first place. As someone who had to go through a 4.5-month challenge of my election, where out of almost 52,000 votes cast, ultimately I won by only 4, and with the examination of those votes, the subpoenas, everything that went on, there was no voter fraud. There was no voter fraud, and that's still not an issue. Forrest, you were talking about Texas being at the bottom in terms of voter turnout. Why in the hell are we talking about suppressing votes or coming up with things that make it more difficult when we need to get more people out to the polls? And it seems that having a voter ID law that is not necessary, and it's ironic that my voter registration card is not even necessary for me to vote. I have to have other forms of identification, not my voter registration card, to vote. I just believe that the discussion we're having is one that has been fabricated out of a non-necessity, when indeed our discussion and our different way we might approach it as Republicans and Democrats or independence or whatever, is what do we do to get more people to the polls? The integrity of the vote is there, as far as I'm concerned. It's what do we do to get more people there? And so until we have that discussion, I don't see this as being anything other than a political move to actually discourage voting.
Let me respectfully disagree with my good friend, Representative Howard, who's here. Look, I served on the Dallas County Citizens Elections Advisory Committee for several years before I became an elected representative, and I can tell you we had volumes of instances where there was voter fraud. It does indeed exist. Now, does it exist at the level of situations where someone is saying they are who they are, the ones that you're referring to? We don't see many instances of that. We see more voter harvesting than any other issue. I'll concede that this measure doesn't address that. But to ask for integrity at the ballot box is not an unreasonable proposition, right? And to go back to your point, and I can take the countervailing argument regarding your position, which is we only do this in order to suppress Hispanic and African-American votes. And I can tell you, this Republican is Hispanic. My grandmother and her family and all my family vote in ways that you might deem to be that were somehow being suppressed. But I can tell you, that's not the objective of these measures. We are truly seeking out integrity at the ballot box. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in one of her pronouncements, said, in Texas particularly, there are 500,000 situations where this would result in someone not being able to cast a ballot. And yet we've gone through three election cycles now where this measure was on the books, and we've had only a pittance of instances where someone claimed they were unable to cast a ballot because of the restrictive nature of the measure.
Is it the dog that didn't bark? Is it the dog that didn't bark? Is the presumption on the citizen to prove that they're a citizen and entitled to vote, or is it the presumption that the state has the right to challenge you, every person that walks up to a voting box, to prove that they're? I would argue the former, that the presumption is with the citizen, not with the state.
So,
I have no opinion on that.
Oh, it's a good discussion.
There's one more quick ironic thing that should be noted. The Democrats, we've been dumping on Republicans on this. Democrats had a really good, relatively speaking, voter ID bill that they chubbed to death in the House prior to the one that ultimately did pass. The one that Todd Smith authored was actually in many ways a model voter ID bill, if you're going to have one. And for whatever, well, I know what the reasons were, but they ended up using local and consent calendar to kill 3 or 4 weeks of the session, and the bill was actually a pretty damn good bill. Lots of options for proving that you were a citizen.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Texas Observer Radio. On this week's show, highlights from our post-election wrap-up event taped in Austin on November 11th. Here once again is Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder.
I think we could maybe turn a little bit away from the election and look forward to the session, which is, does anybody know how many days away?
I think
60-ish, okay. What dynamic do we expect? I mean, I think one of the themes or one of the questions is going to be how the Senate is going to act now that we have a new lieutenant governor in place and a relatively new new set of senators, Republicans of the kind of Tea Party bent. Does anybody want to speak to the expected dynamics both within the Senate and how the Senate and the House may play off each other on the level of politics, but also policy, what bills we can look forward to and how they might move?
Well, Dan Patrick is in a really comfortable position. If you do believe that he is looking to run for governor or another office someday, he's in a position with his Senate that he can file or pass bills that are very popular with the conservative primary voters and have them either killed by Strauss or vetoed by Abbott, making them unpopular in the process and establishing him as a kind of warrior figure for priorities that are not getting addressed at the legislature. I think it's going to be a really interesting dynamic. I mean, after this long, expensive election cycle, we still don't know very much about what kind of governor Greg Abbott is going to be, whether he's going to be a strong or weak figure with the legislature, or even what his policy priorities are. He's talked to editorial boards and in some other ways about the need to increase state investment in infrastructure and education and these other priorities, and I think it's just going to be very difficult for him to do that. He's not going to have a lot of space to maneuver, I think.
I have a few opinions. First of all, let's simply say that Patrick, to a certain degree, is in a box. The biggest winner out of this election was the Republican primary voter. Up until now, the only group that Patrick has ever had to satisfy has been Republican primary voters. Now he has 31 senators. He's not a senator anymore. He doesn't even get to caucus with them unless they invite him into the back room to caucus with him. Right now, everybody is making nice and reaching out, and the Republicans are holding fundraisers, even the ones that don't like him or don't trust him are holding fundraisers. And let's just look at it. One quick thing. He can be either the impeccable showman or the impeccable mechanic. And he really, I say that as seriously as I can. He can build coalitions, and he can make the place work. But he also has to play to a second constituency, which is a talk radio audience. Many of you may not know that David Dewhurst was taken out of the chair twice during the time that Dan Patrick was a state senator. The real policy is not made on the floor of the Senate. Whoever's in the chair is presiding. The real policy is in the Betty King room when the Senate caucuses or the Republicans and the Democrats caucus. And there are, by my count, three factions of Republicans right now that he has to deal with before he even gets to the Democrats. The first are some of the most conservative freshmen and sophomores who are the most ideological. The second group are the senior members, the Seligers and the L-types and the Craig Esteses, who know that they are really miniature governors. And the third group is, and I say this mostly just to tick off Tim Dunn, who is Michael Quinn Sullivan's benefactor, for those of you who don't know. The Republican House members that are senators come from the House that Strauss built. They're not housebroken, they're Straussbroken. They've seen process work. They know how to exercise power. They have respect for procedure, and I don't know which way they're going to go. When you look at them, they all are very responsive to big corporate interests, and that's not said negatively. That's part of the party culture. But the Tea Party is anti-institutional. It is anti-corporate. It's anti-party. And I think that Patrick just managing his Republicans, is, not in the first 60 days, but when we start getting into serious stuff, is going to have a whole series of issues. And the Democrats may well in the Senate just sit back and say, it's your show. Let's see what you guys do.
On day one of the House in January 13th, there's going to be a vote. Now, historically, what's happened is the Tea Party has rabble-roused and said they're going to run and they're going to challenge the Speaker, and you know we're going to have this vote, and then right before they bail. They bail, and we do it by unanimous consent, and then we all support the Speaker. Well, this year, what we've been promised by certain members of our House, good friends of mine, is that there will indeed be a vote. There is going to be a vote on day one. And people think, well, what's the status of the Speaker's race, Jason? And they ask me that. And I tell you, there is no Speaker's race. This race is over. It is a fait accompli. Speaker Strauss will prevail, and he will prevail by overwhelming numbers. In fact, I love Scottie Turner. He's a very good man, a godly man, a person who I have great respect for, and he has a great future in the party. But I would be surprised if he exceeds 15 votes on that night. And that's something that I think is very telling about the tenor of the House. Now, we still have a Senate that will be, I think, the most conservative Senate that we've seen in a generation. And, you know, I know that that Lieutenant Governor Patrick will be focused on advancing some of those conservative agenda items. But in the end, we do have this conflict between the tenor of the Senate and the tenor of the House, and we're going to have to find a reasonable middle ground to get us to advance the agenda of Texas. And conflict is good. We're going to have some of that. I think the session goes longer because of that conflict, but I think ultimately it's a good thing for the people of Texas to have these kinds of debates.
Representative Howard, how about being a Democrat in the legislature, and obviously in the House in particular? There's not a supermajority this time, but the numbers break obviously very heavily in favor of the Republicans. What's your agenda? What's your approach and that of your colleagues as well?
Well, I've actually served where we had a 76-74 House, and I've served where we had a 101-49 House. And so I've seen kind of both ends of the spectrum there. And last time, when we got up to having 55 Democrats, what I found was that that was enough of a critical mass, if you will, to actually have some opportunities for leveraging some things. Now, Jason was talking about, I think it was you a while ago, talking about the makeup. I can't remember now exactly. But anyway, a lot of people say that our House is basically three parties. You probably say this, Harvey. You know, we've got the Tea Party Republicans, we've got the so-called mainstream Republicans, and we've got the Democrats, and we're kind of divided 50-50-50 there for our 150 House members. So when you have over 50 Democrats, you at least have the opportunity to build some coalitions to actually have some effective change occur, progress, in my opinion, moving forward. And I think that was evidenced last session in particular, my first session to serve on appropriations, when we were able to build some coalitions among Democrats and Republicans that got more funding continually added into public education than was originally offered to us, if you will. So certainly when you get to the summer and the special sessions, all of that fell apart. And you see the issue with having so few Democrats. But under the leadership of Speaker Strauss, I think that we're going to be focused on continuing to try to work on those issues that we can find some agreement for working towards solutions, such as with infrastructure, such as with even if we're not going to look at the whole school finance issue, we're going to be focused on some of the things that we can do until we get to the point of actually really fully addressing school finance. We've already got an informal working group of some Republicans and Democrats that are meeting right now, representing different types of school districts throughout the state, trying to come up with what are some of the things that we can do to get some more funding into all of the schools in our state, short of actually redoing the whole school finance system. So my point being that I think even with 52, that though it's going to be difficult, and we're going to have a hard time getting some of our agenda through there, that it at least gives us enough members, if we stick together and work with some coalitions of Republicans who feel similarly to us on finding some kind of workable solutions and that awful C word of compromise, but that some are willing to do, that we can actually affect change.
We'll get to your questions in just a minute or two, but I wanted to hear if anybody else wanted to address what other issues we should be watching going into the session.
I think it's going to be a really probably quite boring session. In other words, probably a pretty good session for the state, but bad for journalists. I think everyone's tired of social issues, as far as I can tell. After last summer, I think the Republicans felt like they got a pretty big win on social issues, and there's not much energy for doing that again. Open carry means there's a guns issue coming through, and let's see, it's actually, I mean, it sounds like really inflammatory, but 47 states have open carry already. It doesn't really cause people to carry guns in public. It's just kind of a, you know, it'll get through, it'll pass, and that's like the guns lobby's happy. There's a lot of focus, I think, on the Tea Party side about doing transportation funding, which is actually a really great priority to do. I mean, we have been neglecting this for too long. We passed Prop 1 statewide this year, which is part of the solution, but not the entire solution. So if the Tea Party is motivated to really tackle that, that's great. And then beyond that, the state's going to be awash in money, so it's a chance to do things like road funding without cutting necessarily into school funding. So I guess the thing that I'm most worried about looking at the ledge is that there's a lot of people in the ledge, and mostly on the Republican side, frankly, who are not really good at budget math.
And I think that's actually going to be the biggest debate we're going to have, is what to do with the budget, obviously. And this the terminology that you used, Erica, of a wash, I think, in money. And the whole narrative that we have now, that we're going to have all this surplus money, you know, we have many, many holes in our current budget. and some of them are dependent upon surplus. The 2006 property tax swap was never a full swap. It was always dependent on surplus to cover a huge chunk of change there. And we never fully fund Medicaid. We're going to have to pay for that when we come back. And you know, we've continually discussed, Jason, the speaker's directive that we work toward diminishing the number of dollars that we're using that were dedicated for another purpose, and we're holding them back from appropriating them in order to certify the budget. We've got $4 billion of those right there. So this whole concept of having extra money, and we had a bill filed that's going to eliminate the franchise tax totally. You know, I mean, my big concern now is how we're going to have a rational, reasonable discussion about the budget with a lot of the new folks that are coming in to the session who think we have a huge surplus. And indeed, we have a surplus in terms of what wasn't appropriated, but we have huge holes in the current budget that have to be plugged somehow. So
I read Erica Greeter every morning when she has a piece. I think she's one of the smartest writers out there. I'm surprised by her position on this, that it's going to be an uneventful session. I can tell you, my admonition would be get your popcorn ready, because I think this is going to be a lot of fun. I think we're going to have three parties, as you point out, and I think there's going to be wrestling matches between all three constituencies at any moment in time. We are going to have conflict. You're going to see bills that emerge. I mean, take a look at the 171 that were filed in the last 2 days. We're going to have bills that emerge that we are going to fight over. There is this schism between the far right and the common sense conservatives, and I think that plays out. I think it's going to be very interesting, more attuned to the 82nd legislature than the 83rd. Now, this instance, we do have more resources to be able to provide for Texas, but that doesn't eliminate these sort of fundamental issues that we fight about. And make no mistake, Republicans can always find social issues to get behind. My only concern, and this is one that I've shared with Representative Howard before, is that, you know, we have 140 days to advance the agenda of Texas. We've got a public school finance system that the Supreme Court has said is unconstitutional. We've got an underfunded transportation system that we have to deal with. We've got an infrastructure problem with our electricity grids that needs to be addressed. And we've got 140 days constitutionally for the biennium to fix it. And that doesn't even include the debate we're going to have on the budget that we have. And so we've got a very limited period of time to do real work for the people. And I just get troubled anytime we get bogged down in those issues that seem to be more divisive than the ones that impact the people in this room. So I know that Representative Howard shares my focus and concern on the issues that are really impactful for Texans. She's common sense. I'm common sense. We happen to be on different parties, but I'm hopeful that in the end, the common sense Texans move forward and win this battle rather than the ideologues on either side of the party.
And that'll do it for this week's episode of Observer Radio, a post-election special recorded live at the North Door in Austin. Before we go, thanks as always to Rosie and the Ramblers for our intro and outro music, and of course, a big thanks to all you out there listening to us. For more sharp reporting from the strangest state in the union, visit us at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of The Observer at many fine booksellers around the state.